Hi, everybody, and welcome to our PyPodcast series of hidden figures of Python. And today we have as a guest Sheena O'Connell, all the way from South Africa. PyPodcast, in case anybody forgot, we are a community-driven podcast, and our aim is to highlight voices from underrepresented groups in the Python community. We also have a code of conduct, which is on our website at pypodcast.live/conduct. When we're working with members of the community, we follow the PSF code of conduct and to help our interactions and keep Python a positive, successful, and growing community. So please be mindful about that when you interact with our material online. So today's hosts are Chuck and me. So I'm Teresa. I live in Hamburg and I'm part of the PyLadies Hamburg, and I'm also data and career coach and data freelancer.
Hi, I'm Chuck, and I love Python. Okay, that's it. So we have our guest Sheena here. So Sheena, do you want to introduce yourself?
I've been coding for a long time in Python. It is my love language. And I got to spend about 5 years working in tech education in the nonprofit space in South Africa. And it was great, and I learned a lot there. So now what I'm doing is I teach for a living, and I try to get other educators connected and leveling up in nice ways. So I've got a company that does advanced Django training and soft skills training, because that stuff's actually pretty hard. And I run a community called the Guild of Educators, where anybody who teaches code or wants to teach code can come and join and hang out. We're starting a teacher's mentorship program. So if you want to help a teacher level up, then you can join that. Or if you're a teacher who wants to get better at code, come and join that. And then the last thing that I'm involved with at the moment is PyCon Africa. So I'm currently the local chair of PyCon Africa. It's happening in my hometown in Johannesburg, South Africa.
And actually, I do have a lot of questions about Johannesburg and PyCon Africa. Shall we start with PyCon Africa, and then we can also talk more about your work?
Sounds good.
Yeah, so for PyCon Africa, I wonder, like, so for folks who never heard of it, like, is it always going to be in, you know, South Africa, or is it going to be traveling around, and do you have an other organization behind it, and how does it work?
Good questions. It does travel around, so it's not always in the same country. This is the first time we're doing it in South Africa. It's the first time we're doing a major, like, international Python conference in Southern Africa. So it's quite a, I think it's going to be quite impactful. But yes, it travels around. I'm not actually sure where we'll do it next year. PyCon Africa is basically run by two separate organizations. There's the international committee, and those are the folks who just, like, stay with the conference wherever it goes. And then there's the local committee. So the people on the ground who know what's what to organize the venue and all of that. So our local committee generally organizes PyCon South Africa every year. And, like, it's quite an experienced team. It's quite a small team, but do good stuff. Yeah, so that's how it works. So we're basically joining forces.
Yeah. What do you expect to be different from, like, let's say last year PyCon South Africa?
All right. So it's going to be a bigger conference. We are reaching further. We're getting a lot more international attention, and we've got some interesting people who are attending. So, for example, Dawn Wages is one of our keynotes, and she's the president of the PSF, and that's wonderful. And it's going to be great to bring her here. So I don't think we would be able to get as, like, high profile people in for PyCon South Africa generally. So that's one of the things. But the other thing is that we're putting a lot more effort into giving financial assistance to folks who otherwise would not be able to come. So we're working hard to try and bring people in from the surrounding Southern African countries and folks from across Africa as well. But we really want to, like, because this is the first big international conference in Southern Africa for Python, we want to just make good use of that. So yeah, a lot of effort is being put into financial assistance, and that's expensive. So we're doing a lot more around fundraising. We've got a donations drive as well that's going to help with that. Yeah, so those are the main differences.
What are the challenges of organizing a conference in Africa? Because you have world travel, right? You have seen PyCon US, EuroPython, all these different conferences. So what are the challenges to organize a conference in Africa compared to, let's say, you know, PyCon US or a European conference?
So I think I've never organized a conference anywhere else, so I can't give a direct comparison, but I can say that there are probably challenges that are standard across the board. I mean, PyCon Africa is, in a way, a newish conference. It's been going on for a little while, but it's had some gaps and things like that. So like a more established conference has better systems in place and has better documentation in place and things like that. And so there's a lot of just figuring things out and swarming. And whenever you want to get, it's a large group of people who are involved. Like there's a lot of people on the international committee. And if you've got a large group of volunteers, then it's kind of hard to figure out, like wrangling volunteers is hard in general, especially if you want to do things to a deadline and to a high standard and not end up doing everything yourself and things like that. So there's a lot of just like management challenges, like figuring out who are the productive people and what skills does everybody bring to the table and things like that. Like that's been tricky. And I think in Africa specifically, there are challenges around like network connectivity and things like that. That comes up. And it's also somewhat challenging because we do have people who are organizing who are in different time zones. And so we need to wrangle schedules quite a lot. And some people have jobs, some people don't have jobs, some people are students. And so that's all challenging to wrangle. And there's also a lot of cultural differences. So our international committee is spread across multiple countries. And a lot of the time when people think of Africa, they think of it as like, just like a blob and everything's the same. And it's really not. Like there are very big cultural differences between different African countries. And those cultural differences come with different norms and therefore different expectations and different misunderstandings. So it's important to just take a lot of care in communicating. Like chaos is the default state. And so you have to work hard to make sure that things are well organized. I think those are the main things.
I wanted to ask a little bit about, you've been in different communities and also in Europe. And as Chuck said, also in the States, you saw PyCon US. How is the community different in Africa or South Africa? Okay. So can you speak for both or...
Yeah. So I've only been to PyCon South Africa and PyCon Namibia in Africa. And even these two communities are very, very different. So in South Africa, Python is already a very well-established language. So most of the big corporates are using it in some way. Most of our attendees are professional people. They're pretty sorted. And we do get a lot of young folks as well who are keen to get into Python in different ways. So that's great. But it's the fact that it's established and there's a lot of knowledge in the country already, a lot of skill there, it makes things easier. If you go to somewhere like Namibia, where it's not an industry standard, then things get more difficult. It's like it's a fledgling community in a way. Like the community is strong and connected and they do stuff and they run their conference and it's all wonderful. But like people need somebody to learn from a lot of the time. And so with something like PyCon Namibia, one of the things that one of the goals there is to bring skills in so that we can share skills with the Namibian community. Yeah, so it varies from place to place. And I'm sure that a lot of African countries are more similar to Namibia than to South Africa. And we've got it, like it's pretty good here.
When did you get started with Python and how?
So I got started when I was in university. I was coding for food. I learned to code like as a teenager and I really liked it. So when I was studying, I needed money and so I was just taking on these odd jobs. And at one point, somebody offered me a Django development gig. They wanted to build this like soccer membership website thing. And they were like, can you write a Django website? And I said, yes. And then I figured out how to. And through learning Django, like there was this book called The Django Book, but now it's very out of date and it's not a thing anymore. But that was my introduction to Python. Yeah, so I learned that and I learned Python sort of as a side effect of trying to do this. And it was great. It just fitted my brain really well. Since then, like Python wasn't taught in university or anything like that when I was there. After university, I gravitated towards software development jobs and I did a bunch of different things, but I always missed Python. And then as soon as I could work with Python again, I jumped on it.
Yeah. I mean, I can ask more stuff, but you read a programming book. Do you still read programming books?
Bits and pieces sometimes, but it's very rare for me to read a whole programming book. I read a book on PHP once for a job, but like I haven't learned a lot of languages since I've learned Python. I've I've done a bunch of different things. I've learned PHP and I think C sharp. I find that I learn best often by getting my hands dirty. So I'll dig into documentation. And something that I find as well is that like a lot of the concepts from one language are transferable to another. So if like a function is a function is a function. So a lot of the time when learning a different language, it's like you want to figure out how the concepts you already know map to this other thing. And then you want to find out what kind of the idioms are of the new language. So often my way of learning is very, I wouldn't say it's chaotic. It's directed towards a goal. I'll want to do a specific thing and then I'll go and find out how to do like all the little pieces that I need to know in order to achieve that thing. Yeah. I think I did read the Kubernetes book. Yeah. What else? I don't know.
I actually wonder how many people are like learn things like that, because I am the same. Like I can only learn if I am doing it, because otherwise I would just be, you know, this side in, that side out. Right? Like, it's like, oh yeah, it's a good read, but then like, what is it about? Can't remember. So,
yeah, I think for me, project-driven learning is very helpful. So it's like you want to learn a thing. Like, let's say when I learned React or something like that. Like I've learned a bunch of different tools, and these tools have different tutorials that you can follow, and you can follow the tutorial and you can stay on that golden path and learn what they want you to learn, and you get the major concepts and you get the major building blocks, and you're like, okay, cool, how do I get it to do this other thing? And then you research that and you end up learning more, and you find out where you need to go deeper. So that's useful for me, but I do think that books are helpful in a lot of places as well, because it does give you a narrative flow and it helps you to kind of stay on task. For folks who are newer to programming language, I would usually say like find a structured resource to learn from, because there's just so much stuff out there. The signal to noise ratio is really bad. So if you just find like one good trusted source and you use that as a starting point, then that's probably good.
Yeah.
Is this why you got into teaching as well? As because you felt like the material out there is more noise than...
Not really. So even in the noise, there's a lot of good stuff. It's just that there's like people pull each other in all sorts of different directions. For me, teaching was something that I always wanted to do in some way. Like I've always been teaching. Like when I was a little kid, I used to teach grown-ups Excel skills, and I taught the other kids maths and tutored them, and I've taught people different sports, and it's always been a thing in my life, but it's not something that I pursued as a career, but it's always been something that I've cared about. Like it's always clicked with me really well. So I was a really awkward kid, and helping people with their homework was a good source of connection. So I think a lot of it comes from that. Yeah. Then
wait, you did that for free?
Some people paid me, but I've also
did that for free.
And when I was in school, like tutoring people and stuff, sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depended on the situation. Yeah.
Okay, I did it. I got paid.
So people become your friends so they can borrow your homework, like the morning after the deadline.
No.
Borrowing was for free, but...
I liked helping people to understand stuff. That was always a thing. So I didn't like my homework in exchange for friendship. that would be a bit sad. But it was a way to connect. It's like, cool, you want to get better at this thing. Let's nerd out about it. Like if you're teaching a person a thing and you really want them to understand something, then you have to understand them. So you do build some connections there. And I found that a lot with my students as well more recently. It's like, you really do, like you get into each other's heads a little bit. But back to your question about like how I got into teaching, I've been working for a bunch of startups and I was feeling thoroughly burnt out and used up. And I was thinking about what I really wanted to do. I was like, I've been working so hard chasing other people's dreams. And what do I want to do? It's like, I want to make an impact on people's lives. And education is a really amazing way to do that. I mean, if you think about it, you just have like a bunch of conversations with a person and then their trajectory changes in a massive way. And sometimes it's not even that hard to move a person quite significantly. So I got to a point where I was like, cool, I want to work in education. I want to start a code school for women. I want to do this. This is going to be great. And then I was thinking about like, okay, what does it take to start a code school? I'm going to need desks and a venue and HR and payroll and all of these like things that I'm not that interested in. And if you think about like the business of education, there's like so much stuff that you need to do that isn't teaching. And so I was bashing my head on this for a while, but at the time I was like taking on like random little freelance gigs and just trying to get more exposure. So I went to a PyCon South Africa event and I ran a workshop there. And I literally just did it so that more people could see what I was about. I wanted more exposure and I wanted to teach people a thing and I wanted to learn a thing. So I did that. Now with PyCon South Africa, you can charge for your workshops. That's just how it usually goes. But I decided not to charge for mine because I was just like, bring more people. And so because my workshop was the cheapest, it was very full of students. And some of those students were from this nonprofit coding bootcamp. And they kind of swarmed me afterwards and they were like, this is great. Don't you want to come and run a workshop at our place? And I was like, okay. Cool, I'll try that out.
For free? Or you can charge them this time?
No, I was just like, cool, I'll just do it for free because like these people obviously don't have a lot and they're obviously like really, really hungry to learn. I'm a sucker for teaching. So I went there and I did that and I ran a couple of workshops and I got to know the people who were running the place and I got to see what their education system was like and it wasn't good enough. And so I ended up working there and eventually being their CTO. So I started off working part-time and then ramped up and ramped up and ramped up. And then I was just like part of the woodwork. So when I started working there, it was very scrappy. And I like scrappy. But the syllabus itself that they were teaching it had big gaps in it. It was like, they'd have a couple of paragraphs to read about unit testing. It's like, cool, now you know unit testing. So what I did was I built out some new programs for them and I just kind of solidified the stuff that they had and made it really, really solid. And through doing that, I learned a lot about teaching and about brains and about like how to teach the basics of Python and other languages. There was JavaScript there as well. And that was cool. And then COVID happened. So we were originally an on-premises training provider and we had about 250 students working in this converted underground parking lot. Basically, we had this apartment building and then there was a parking lot and like another parking lot with natural light, and we converted that into studios. And so we had like all these students in there and we helped them out with cheap accommodation around the building as well. And then when COVID happened, we had to send everybody home, but we had to keep supporting them as well. So ended up building a whole lot of tooling to help with remote teaching, and it worked super, super well. And again, like learned a ton about just like how to keep people motivated and connected remotely. Yeah, that changed my life and trajectory.
I think I can totally relate to that. I think I was also working at a bootcamp school right before COVID and then during COVID. And I also had like a lot of lessons learned already from my previous job when we had a team in Berlin and a team in Hamburg. And we were trying to kind of work hybrid, which was always a mess. And so I was like, yeah, that thing where five people are in the room and five people are at home is not working out very well. Either everybody's at home.
Yeah, we didn't do hybrid.
Do you think, like, because you said that like the biggest change is that you give this workshop in PyCon South Africa, so do you think the community kind of changed your life in some way?
Oh yeah, many times over. So there was that one that was very impactful. A couple of years later, just like on a whim, I was like, let's see if there are any international conferences that I can maybe get to. And my first international conference was a DjangoCon US. I applied and I asked for a grant and I was just like, probably nothing will come of this, but I got to go. And that's where I met a bunch of the DjangoCon Africa folks. And that was also impactful. And I met a lot of other people there that I connected with quite well and I'm like friends with. And they've supported me in a bunch of the things that I've been doing, and I support them where I can as well. Meeting the DjangoCon Africa people was lovely. I helped organize the first DjangoCon Africa that was in Tanzania, in Zanzibar, which is epic. And met some amazing people there again. And it sort of snowballed from there. So now I speak at a lot of international conferences. I've been asked to keynote in all sorts of fancy places, which has been epic as well. And I've learned a lot. Like, I've learned about different tools and technologies that have changed my opinion of, like, what is worth focusing on and what is worth teaching and what I recommend to organizations. So that's been really good and impactful. And some of the connections that I've made there as well have been good. So, like, networking, like business networking, can sometimes feel a little bit slimy in different ways, but it's been a really good networking opportunity. So I go to these different conferences and I try to talk to as many people as I can, and I try to add value and I try to connect people with other people and join different dots. And it's an experience every time. It's very stimulating and I learn a bunch every time. But some pretty good opportunities have come out of it as well. So I would say that, yeah, Python conferences have changed my life. It's been very, very good.
Oh, it's good to hear that, because I feel the same. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great. How did they change your life?
Well, I mean, this is your podcast, so I would wait until I got to be a guest in another podcast.
Okay, I'll invite you to something.
Yeah, I think nobody knows Chirk when they go to a conference and everybody's like, oh, who's Chirk? No, yeah, nobody. Yeah. So I like to always also ask something about, what do you do besides Python and teaching? And
do you mean like hobbies and fun stuff? Or
I don't know. Is it hobbies or is that another passion that you have? It depends on the level of involvement, I guess.
Yeah, so I do have different passions. Python is a thing that takes up a lot of my time. Teaching in general takes up a lot of my time. The non-Python stuff is soft skills. So I do train people in different soft skills. So one of the products that I have at the moment is, it's for helping teams become better teams. So basically what I do is I go and like if there's a team that's struggling to team in some way, then I will gather a bunch of information and do a bunch of surveys and talk to people in the team and their leadership and figure out like what's actually going wrong or and what's going right as well, because often a lot of things are going right. They can be amplified. Often there's like weird structural issues that have strange pitfalls and side effects that people aren't fully aware of. Sometimes there's some cultural differences within the team. There's like all sorts of weird, complicated things that happen. And then based on that, I come up with like a course specifically for that team that covers different skills that they are likely to need. But it's not really like, you can't just tell a person how to be a good teammate and then they go and be a good teammate. It doesn't work like that, because a lot of things are down to habits and small changes, and that's not something you can just do once off. So these courses typically take a while. So I'm running a 12-week course at the moment, and I'm not seeing everybody every week or every day. Like, I'm seeing them once every 2 weeks, basically. Like on average. But then between that time, they are given different challenges and exercises that help them to team better. And yeah, it's been really, really good. So I suppose my other strong interest is organizational psychology and just like how to be a good teammate.
And do people follow through?
So it's tricky. A lot of people do. Some people don't. Whenever you run training for a corporate where where the training participants have been told to be there, then like there will be resistance, especially if they've been told to be there because it's like, you're going to be a better teammate now. Like, you need some soft skills. Like, people don't always receive that very well. And so, yeah, there's a couple of different ways to get buy-in. And buy-in is so, so important. Like, one of the biggest challenges of adult education is motivation and focus, because there's so many different things that take our attention and want our attention. And many of these things are very important. And sometimes you just don't want to learn the thing. So what I do is I try to make the training hyper relevant. So I find out from the individuals in the team what they want, what problems they see, what good they want to grow. And then I frame things in a way that shows them like, cool, these things that you want, we're actually going to cover that. And this thing that I was going to cover, I can tweak it so it covers this other thing that you're interested in. So that's part of it. It's just like actually being direct about like, cool, I'm going to give you what you want to some extent, to some reasonable extent. Then the other thing is showing people that by taking part in the training, they can actually support each other's growth. So sometimes you'll get people who show up who are like, yeah, I don't need this. Like, I'm a great team player always, and I don't need this, but those other guys need this. So for those people, you can say, cool, like, your voice is actually really useful here because you clearly know some stuff. You can help to direct this training. Like, your input is going to be useful to the people around you. So that's helpful. So far I haven't. So like with the course I'm running at the moment, there's about 30 people and they're very, very multicultural. And it's a very complicated team structure. If you're familiar with the Team Topologies book, I don't read a lot of programming books, but I read a lot of like business books and like structure books. But Team Topologies is kind of a book about design patterns for organizing teams in complicated organizations. And they've got a bunch of different configurations. So like sometimes you'll have a team that's focused on a specific project or a specific like type of work. And sometimes you'll have a team that is actually distributed in different ways. Like you get this thing called an enabling team. And an enabling team, like they're kind of like a guild and they level up their skills and they level up their tools, but then the individual members will go and help other teams level up in the same way. So it's about enabling different projects. So the team that I'm working with is something like an enabling team and something like a platform team. And so it's just like a really weird structure to work in.
So it's kind of like a data team, right?
Yeah, kind of like a data team. Kind of like if you imagine a big organization that has lots of software projects and then you have a security team, mm-hmm. just handle security. Like imagine how they would need to work. Like they can't go and fix all the problems themselves, but they can kind of build a paved road that other like project, like product specific teams can walk along, and they can go and share skills and they can define like maturity levels for different projects and just kind of put ownership of quality on other people, but still keep an eye on things and maintain that level. So yeah, it's been interesting.
I just wanted to say that it's kind of the same. It reminds me of when we were at work and we were always saying, we don't need a retrospective this month or this 2 weeks, like this time, you know, we have no problems, you know, everything is fine. And then you do a retrospective and then it's like, 1 hour was not enough. It's like, yeah, to talk about all the things that we have no problem with. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Often I find that, well, there's this exercise that I'm doing with this team in particular. Like we're talking about different concepts and why they matter, like why psychological safety matters, why dependability matters, and how these things are related and things like that. But then an exercise that I do with people is a Kaizen thing. So Kaizen is a Japanese business philosophy thing about making small changes. And you can make like tiny improvements to how you work. And those tiny improvements, even if they seem insignificant, they add up and they can do big things. So then people come up with their own little improvements that they want to make and they commit to it in a public way. And then they go and they do those things. And coupled with that, I get folks to pay attention to each other and try to notice the good things that are happening so that they can say like, hey, I saw you do this good thing. Well done. And that's been really, really cool. So like, here's an example of a small Kaizen thing that a person can do. So one of the people in the team was like, every time I go to a stand-up in the morning, I feel really anxious. And then I go into the stand-up and I just like waffle and ramble and then I just feel bad. It's like, okay, how are we going to solve this? We'll solve it by spending like 5 to 10 minutes before the stand-up just thinking about what I'm going to say. And it's like this really, really small thing that she can do. But then she goes to her stand-up and she's prepared. She's not anxious. She's more able to pay attention to the people around her because she's not caught up in her internal anxiety loops. And the rest of the team get better clarity on her tasks and what she needs. And so they're more able to help her. They're more able to focus on her stuff and they're more able to have space to talk about their stuff. So it's like this little tiny thing with potentially a big impact. And there's loads of things like that, like lots and lots.
Yeah. So I have a question for you. So if you have to choose, right, you can either work with Python, the programming language, or you can do both, or people. What would you choose?
So I love Python so much, but I think actually people. And the reason I say that is because in the end, like if you want to build something big, it's a team sport. Like if you're just working by yourself on something, like you can do some pretty epic things, but the most impressive things are generally done by teams of people, and getting people to team well is like, there's just so much to be unlocked. There's so much leverage to be added. People sometimes talk about 10x developers and stuff like that. It's very hard to make a 10x developer. It's very hard to be a 10x developer. It's very hard to find a 10x developer, but you can take a team and make it like a 10x team. And it's not actually that bad to do. Like it's generally like if you just look at it with the right lens and get people to be motivated to make small changes, you can do some amazing things. And you don't necessarily need to stop at 10x either. So that's part of it. And then the other part of it is like LLMs are changing a lot of things, and they are adding a lot of leverage to programmers. And they are also, they're changing the landscape in a lot of different ways. But people are getting to a point where we're realizing what the uniquely human skills are. And if we can grow those human skills, then that's great. So I think that there's a lot of space for just like growing individual people in how they interact with one another.
I think that's a good call, because I think a lot of developers doesn't put that much emphasis on the people element that can really help their career, but they just overlook it. They just thought like, if I'm become quote unquote the best developer, I don't know how you quantified it, but like that, yeah. I would be, you know, I would do really well in my career. But I guess there are a lot of people element in it that developers overlook.
Yeah, I think that works up to a point. And then after that point, you are like, you need to work with other people.
A metaphor I really like is soccer. Or football, depending on where you're from. Your individual skills as a soccer player really matter quite a lot. But most of the game of soccer, like if you watch people practice soccer, a lot of emphasis is placed on passing the ball really, really well. And that means setting the next person up for success. And that means also being aware of what other people are doing. Like you need that context. And so that means paying attention to things outside of your little bubble. But it also means just taking care as you craft different things. So let's think about a pull request as a ball passing moment. Like how can you craft a pull request to set the next person up for success? Like make it clear and specific, and don't do a million different things at once. Don't make it like a mega pull request that's just going to confuse people. If you make it super huge, then whoever's reviewing it might, they're a human, they might lose focus. If you make it small so that they can fit it in their brain, then they will do a better job. So like there's all sorts of different ways to just like make that one interaction better. Another way you can pass the ball is like asking a person for help. You can ask a person for help well or badly. And you can build up, like you can build these skills. A lot of really good, like technically skilled developers, they'll hear about these teamwork good practices and they'll nod and smile and then just like make massive weird PRs anyway, because they don't necessarily value passing the ball well. And that harms people in their team or to affect productivity.
Yeah, I think it's not only, I think sometimes what I noticed was not necessarily that people don't value passing the ball well, but it's hard. It's a lot. It's a different work. It's different work to do that well compared to just coding, you know, a lot, and like really making it bite-sized and whatnot. So that's kind of like it. I think it's more of a subconsciously, it's like learning a new skill, and you need to want to learn. To be in a space where you want to learn.
So I guess it's like kind of like when you pass a ball, like I learned it when I was like playing in the playground, right? Like when I was a very, again, like I'm not really good at sports. I have no like sporty nerve in me. So I'm suck at like, you know, even passing the ball, right? Mostly just like hit my head or I just miss it and have to chase after it, right? So I was told how to like really do the ball pass is to like when you pass the ball, you have to make sure looking at the other person, make sure they are ready, you are ready, and then you have to aim at giving the ball to them rather than just whatever floated. So I think that's the difference, right? Like if you just kind of float it, it's like, oh, you didn't catch it, that's your fault. It's like, no, but you didn't tell me that you're going to float at me, and then like of course I didn't catch it. It hit my face and like whatever, right? Like so. You know, that, you know, actually just passing a ball is different from just randomly throwing a ball at people. So it's, and also people always think, oh, it's your fault that you didn't catch it. It's like, but it, no, it's your fault that you didn't pass it well. So yeah.
Yeah. Like the ball metaphor can be passed, can be pitched pretty far, because sometimes in a professional environment, people will take the ball and then they'll put it down and walk away.
like that could drop the ball, right?
It's like somebody will deal with this.
Also, there's people who collect balls.
Oh, yes.
Oh, collect more than they can handle, right? Like this handful of balls.
It's just like, this is a beautiful football and this is a beautiful ping pong ball. And it's like, just, you know, collecting them. Yeah.
Or like doing tricks with the ball when the goal's right there. But it's like, look at all the fancy stuff I can do. I can bounce it on my head. So we see this a lot.
Yeah. And miss the point, right? Like, oh, you have to put it in the goal, I guess.
Yeah, I think this is sometimes like, I think you can be quite long time in a team without having, especially like companies, they're cutting on budget and everything. And I think, let's say 10 years ago, we were in a space where every team had a scrum master, an agile coach, a, you know, 5 people to help the teamwork, you know, and now it's like, oh, you got to do it yourself again. So I think if you don't explicitly say things like, you know, you are responsible for your pull request to be approved by the end of the sprint, if we're doing sprints, you know, then people are like, Yeah.
I think there is still a use in Scrum Masters and things like that, but I think that people just put too much on them. The original thinking behind Scrum Masters was that they would be Scrum coaches more than masters. It's not like they're there to tell everybody what to do, but they're there to be a coach. And ideally, get into a position where people don't need them so much. That it didn't really go that way. It ended up, things get...
Yeah, I think why people hate like Agile or Scrum is that because companies thought that that's like a, you know, solve all the problem, like ticket to solve all the problem, but it's not. So that's why like it's got misused and people ended up hating them.
Yeah, it got misused a lot. And we see that like Agile implemented badly in lots of different places where they're like, cool, we're going to have sprints. Let's have a plan for the next 10 sprints. What specifically are we going to do in the next 10 sprints? And it's sprinting. That means we're moving really quickly. It's
like, not the point. Yeah, but why? And where are we going? Don't know. Okay. Just run. Okay.
As long as you have the ball. It's like,
yeah, I mean...
Just to come back to the thing you're doing at Prelude, right? You mentioned at the beginning that you're also doing mentorship for teachers. Mm-hmm. So not just, so you're going to the meta level a bit with the teaching.
Yeah. So that's actually with the Guild of Educators. So it's a community I started last year. And I've been like, so there is a craft to teaching well. And a lot of people who want to teach code, they have the coding skill, but not necessarily the experience in teaching. And they'll often mimic what they've already seen. So traditional education systems where you have a sage on the stage and all of that. So that's one aspect of it. Our understanding of what good teaching looks like has changed. The way people learn and study, and like that is something that has been well studied. There is science to back up modern methods that many people just don't know about. Standard schooling where you get everybody to move at the same pace underserves most people. And like it's not like it's all bad. I mean, look how many people can read, that's great. But it can definitely be better. So part of it is about just giving good teaching skills and like mental frameworks to people who want to teach, and giving teachers support structures as well. Like a lot of people get out of teaching because they get frustrated in different ways. Like I think the half-life for teachers in the UK is 7 years. I stand to be corrected, but I mean, that's not long enough. If we could make that half-life longer, that would be really nice. So supporting teachers is a big thing. But then there's also, there are teachers who are teaching technical stuff who aren't necessarily practitioners of that technical stuff. So earlier we spoke about PyCon Namibia, and PyCon Namibia is really, really great because we get to go and hang out with students and show them cool things with code. And we had this day where we were at a local school, and we were doing some Python with the kids, and a bunch of computer studies teachers were there as well. And these teachers were like they were lovely. They showed up, they were hungry to learn, they really wanted to help in lots of different ways. But when you interacted with them, you could see like they don't know that much Python. They don't know that much about the thing that they're there to teach because they just don't have the experience. And so my thinking was that if we paired those folks up with technical practitioners, with developers, and to say like, cool, now you have an expert that you can speak to, then that'll probably affect quite a lot of lives because one teacher affects many, many people. And so the idea with the mentorship program is that it's a completely voluntary thing. It's not like I'm mentoring people and they're paying me or anything like that. It's mentors can show up, or potential mentors can show up and volunteer. Mentees can show up and say like, hey, I need help. And then they get matched together. So a mentee can be there because they want to learn technical skills or because they want to learn teaching skills. And a mentor can also help with either of those things. And a mentor can be a mentee at the same time. That's okay. Now, structurally, like a lot of people get a little bit frightened of becoming a mentor because it's like, oh, if I'm somebody's mentor, it's like this lifetime commitment and they're going to expect hours from me every single day. Yeah. So there's a lot that's in place to make it like safe for the mentors in terms of their own capacity. So we'll do like a matchmaking thing, and a mentor and mentee will be matched together for 12 weeks. That's 3 months. And at the end of that 12-week period, it's like, it's done. They can join again if they want to. During those 12 weeks, they're expected to meet once every 2 weeks for like an hour. And so it's not a big time commitment. That's the minimum commitment. If both the people want to spend more time together, that's great. But it's like, that is all that is required. And then the other thing is that the burden of organizing things goes on to the mentee, not the mentor. So the mentee will say like, cool, we need to meet up. Let's schedule something. So they'll be the scheduler. And they also need to prep the mentor before their session just by saying like, this is roughly what I think we should talk about. And so the mentor doesn't go in blind. They can mentally prepare. So I've run a similar structure before, a similar mentorship structure before when I was working at that non-profit coding bootcamp where I had professional developers mentoring our baby developers. And that was really lovely. So we matched people up and the 12 weeks finished and all of that. And basically every single mentor said that they'd like to be included in the next round. So it was a good experience. So I'm just taking the learnings from there and applying it to a slightly different domain. So get people to teach well, teach Python well specifically. And there are some like interesting side effects as well. So the Guild of Educators has a Discord server and there'll be a channel on there for the mentors. And so the mentors can swap notes with each other. They can say like, oh, this weird thing happened. How do we solve it? Or my mentee is asking about this thing. I don't know about it. Does anybody know about it? So they've got people to lean on and talk to. And I think some really good things can come out of those conversations. And for me, it would be really, really interesting to see what problems people have and how they're solving them. And that's a resource on its own.
Okay, so now come the million-dollar question. How can someone join the Guild of Educators?
So head to guildofeducators.org. You can join just as a regular member. There's a Join Us button. So you can join the Discord server there. And you can fill out a form there and give me your email address. And then you'll get emailed about different news and things when it happens. And then if you want to join the mentorship program, there's a different form to fill out on a different tab.
Yeah, so just go to guildofeducators.org. I hope we put it somewhere like in the description or on the screen. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, we'll get folks the information. So
coming back to the beginning where we talked about PyCon Africa, you showed us what your colleague did as a copy, as inspired by PyCon US. And I thought that is like really cool. And maybe you want to show that.
Awesome. So at PyCon US and other conferences, you get a name tag and then there are stickers and ribbons that you can attach to the name tag in order to say who you are. So you say like, I'm a community member and I like hugs and I'm involved with PyLadies and things like that. So one of the organizers of PyCon Africa is really into 3D printing. It's amazing. And he made these name tags. So this is completely modular. You can take it apart. It's got these like little purple things that hold everything together and these pop out.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. And if you zoom in on this, like this is the PyCon Africa logo. This was done with a 3D printer. And when you print these things, it's a really interesting process because you need to take the transparency of the different colors into account and you can get the 3D printer to kind of mix the colors. Yeah, it's super cool. So we have these like epic name badges. And yeah, like it comes with a little lanyard that you can click in and you can say that you like hugs. I like hugs. So this is this is the process.
Can we have one like this excuse about anything before coffee?
So it's cool. It's going to be a little keepsake for everyone as well. This is the PyCon South Africa over there. That's our national.
I want that now. Okay.
Yeah, because at last PyCon in Germany, Dirk actually just made a really quickly a website to like really quickly, like what else do you do during a conference, where she was like rating swag. People could rate the swag. No, you did that, Dirk.
Yeah, that's more than a swag. That's the name badge. It's so cool.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, exactly. So that's like.
So I need another session for that. So
so now Chuck needs to come to PyCon Africa. See, that's what you had to, start with, and then you get everybody to attend.
I think this is going to become a PyCon South Africa staple. I think it's going to be our standard thing. Because it actually like it takes a while to print the stuff, but we looked at the price of like ordering name badges and things like this, and it's actually comparable. It's like it's pretty close, and this is like the first prototype. The printing has become more efficient, so yeah, it's actually a really good way to go.
And it's unique, and like I think that's the charm of like you have stuff that you made yourself. So
yeah, I think two years ago at Python Pizza in Hamburg, we did the Python logo shaped cookie cutters, also with the
I really want that one as well.
It's awesome.
Can you do it again? And then I would come. I think that's really the end. So we have very, very, you know, limited amount of time. We can talk for ages, but yeah. I guess like seeing Shana travel a lot, we can, you know, next time you see her, you can just, you know,
at
come
PyCon
chat.
In South Africa.
South Africa as well, yeah.
And yeah, so thank you very much for listening to everybody who's listening.
Bye.
Bye.